Yeah.
Take your time to catch your breath.
I'm more out of breath than he is. You're the one that's been
performing.
Tell
me what this is, what this is for.
It's a half-hour program called The Green Room. Mm-hmm. It airs Friday nights at 7:30 on KXTR. Mm-hmm. And it's quite literally a background view of what's happening in the arts in Kansas City. So here we are. Literally, it's perfect. We'll go about 23, 24 minutes, if that's all right. Okay. Lauren Hollander. 3, 2, 1. Lauren Hollander, you've just completed the Cacciatorian Piano Concerto. We're backstage now chatting. The Bartok Concerto for Orchestra is going on in the background in case that comes through. Are you exhausted after a performance like this? It seemed to be a very strenuous one, a very effective one.
No, I'm not. I found that certain energies are raised during the performance, which have a very healing effect. And that, especially if the performance went well, that there is a type of elation and enthusiasm and exuberance which is the net result of keeping the energies going.
May I assume that you're feeling that now? Because it was a splendid performance.
Thank you very much. A lot of work goes into these things. The last 2 weeks I had worked approximately, I would say, 8 hours, sometimes 10 hours, and on two or three occasions 16 hours daily to prepare these series of concerts, not only the Cacciatorian, but the works that we did in St. Louis. So much time and energy and thought and care and self goes into this that it really is an experience of the whole person.
I like to watch a pianist as well as listen to him, and the way you sort of crouch over the keyboard as if you're seeking to wrench something from the innards, I was very struck by that. It's a very focused kind of look. Is that what you're feeling as well?
I find that it becomes a type of dance, that playing the piano is, to me, singing, dancing, and dramatic expression, the way an actor would communicate, and that the piano then becomes my voice. And one must really make love with the instrument. It is a total expressive experience. And in the best nights, you just get out of the way, that you are singing and speaking with the piano. I often feel about the piano the way a guitarist might feel, too, that he embraces the instrument in some way. And I've always felt that to be removed from the instrument or to have a proper seating position just is not the musician. It is more a posture for something that never really existed. And I tend to find that musicians are deeply emotional, feeling creatures, and this is what I try to express.
Well, the word showmanship, I think, can be used here in its best sense, especially during that slow movement. The concentration that you obviously felt was coming across, and I think, if anything, it enhanced our own. Is that a fair interpretation of that?
Well, I think those things certainly operate, that there is a type of mechanism of concentration which, when it's focused, will pull into it those who are attuned, those who are resonating with it. That there are evenings when people are afraid to breathe at certain points, that there is a thread which is held in communicative connection, which is really what human communication is all about. One can feel these things happening even in a one-on-one conversation, although most people avoid it. Their eyes will wander, or they attempt to fill up the silence with talking. But these same mechanisms operate, of course, in music, and when one is involved in the pulse of music and the dramatic expression, and finally the song of music, that there is a very deep connection with some intuitive elements of the human being which we just don't deal with other ways.
And let me take off on the word song, too, because a young lady named Debbie Green filled in, as it were, for the theremin. Have you performed this work with a living soloist as opposed to a theremin before?
And I've always asked for a living soloist. The work is actually not written for a theremin. It's written for something called a flexitone. A flexitone is a very unpleasant instrument, which is a piece of spring steel, but it has two wooden clangers on it. and it is not a singing expressive instrument such as the voice or the theremin. If it were for the theremin, of course, it would be beautiful. The flexitone is a percussive instrument and sounds more like a New Year's Eve noisemaker. What I look for is the singing, wailing, crying sound, which is what a theremin would have and what a singing saw would have. But I have found that the most human element is, of course, the human voice. But I have never run across a soprano who was able to go up to those high notes. Debbie was the first one. I was absolutely blown over when I heard it, and I think that she's an extraordinarily gifted singer. And I just hope that her career takes flight. She gave us all an amazing experience.
Lauren Hollander, when I think of your career, I think of, among other things, a series of exploits. Your willingness to take the piano and its music to a diverse number of surroundings. It's striking. It's something unique in your career, I think, as opposed to many other concert pianists.
Well, when they don't hire you for gigs, you got to take the piano somewhere. Right. I've always gone into places that don't normally have music. I have taken the piano into ghetto schools and hospitals and reformatories and even prisons for maximum security prisoners. And a few years ago, I took the piano out onto the streets of Harlem. I dumped it out in 110th and Lexington and played for the neighborhood. So I've often pioneered in these programs. I have tried to encourage orchestras to break into small groups, to go into the schools, to work with the kids. And to me, these outreach performances often have a very lasting effect. To me, the most exciting project are the college residencies, where I will come to a town for 2 or 3 days and I'll play a recital, but also when I'm at the campus, we'll work with the young musicians and dancers and theater people in questions about creativity and the emotional facets and components of creativity, and work with them on stage fright and fear of performance. And also with some of the questions of career, but also going into music therapy and dance therapy. And finally into questions of human consciousness and the human potential movement and trying to encourage people of opening themselves up to their potential as creative human beings.
In much of what you talk about, I do sense a reference to the highly emotional aspects of music. Maybe a correlative between music and the emotions themselves. Would you go so far as to say that includes things like key signatures? Does music have an aural equivalent to emotions and objects and sights in our own lives?
Oh, most definitely. And the world of the relationship of music to emotions and music to some of the questions of human consciousness, of course, a very, very close relationship. Music was always known as a mystical system of knowledge, and the 12 notes of music are very specific ways of knowing. The keys of music were understood by the great masters and used for different things. Mozart, of course, used E-flat as the key of ecstasy and dealt with it with the masons, and the feeling of E-flat major, A major, G minor. The composers had definite feelings on this. Bach especially chose keys because they meant something to him. We, interestingly, are finding that if one were to simply resonate with the key, that one's experience of self can change. The example I always give is that if there's a timpani and one sprinkles it with salt and then hits the timpani drum, that the salt will line up into a particular shape. That's very true. That's, of course, physical reality. It resonates into that shape. If you change the note of the timpani, the salt will line up into a different shape. Human beings are such resonant creatures, and that E-flat major, one becomes E-flat major. And if one involves oneself in A major, one becomes A major on some level. This, we're finding, is really why the power of music in the various keys has the effect that it does on some level.
I've always wondered what something like the Scriabin, the Mysterium, I think, as he designated it, would be a total musical experience that would involve sight, sound, sense, the whole thing. Is anybody doing experiments in that sort of thing now, or have you ever delved into this aspect of composition?
Well, I've delved very deeply into it, and even beyond composition, into some of the questions of perception and cognition in human beings. I'm very interested in education of art for children, in finding out what the basic creative components are of children and how they become so stifled in the school, and they slowly turn off and become afraid, and afraid of the grown-ups, and afraid to express themselves, and start mimicking what they think the grown-ups want, rather than opening up from where they were coming from as little sensitive creatures.
Albert Brooks, the filmmaker, called it the ultimate horror story. We are growing up to turn into our parents.
Well, it's that's one way of looking at it. I think it's worse that we grow up to fear our parents and to fear the teachers and to fear the grown-ups in the society. This is a real problem. But I think that there is a great deal of research being done in especially education for the gifted, but also creative education, which is looking again at what are the relationships between color and sound and taste and smell and what is the inner experience of these things. I know I have perfect pitch, and then I can hear a chord or any sound, a bell sound, an automobile horn, and know precisely what note it is. But it goes beyond that. I can taste a food and could tell you that if I had to find the notes that to indicate the same sensations in my body of that food, I could do that. Same thing with smell or with sensations, that we are somehow a common denominator, our sensing system between all of the different inputs. And there are those highly sensitive people, well, since written history, that have spoken of these relationships.
We are in an age in which many composers that have been in obscurity for a while are coming back, being revived by pianists. I'm thinking of Lewenthal with Alcan as just one example. Are there some composers in your mind that whose music deserves to be brought back before the public for whatever reason?
Oh, interesting. There are occasional pieces, the Fifth Saint-Saëns, which I did here a few years ago. I've certainly been involved in trying to bring it back. This Khachaturian was just forgotten, and I think it's exciting enough to warrant performance, and a few others, a Copland Piano Concerto, but not of any composers that one wouldn't already know. I don't have really the time to involve myself on that level. I have so many other things in which I'm involved in education and research into the creative process and whatever, plus being a father of two little boys. So it takes time, and preparing the concerts that I play takes the rest of the time. But I think that for my own path, returning to the masters, Mozart, Bach, Beethoven, Schubert, Haydn, these are the ones that to me mean the most, and then the romantic composers. And I'm interested in all composers and what they had to say, and I just think that there are those that are addressing that better than I am.
Well, I was wondering, it's an old question, I suppose, but if you had a chance to premiere, say, a forgotten work or a work that had never even been out of manuscript by a Schubert, but it was an inferior piece, would you go ahead and do it? Is
out of interest, yes, for Schubert certainly. But what we're finding are that in the case of Schubert, that there are probably a dozen works, some major sonatas, which are forgotten, obscured, and not done, that are great works. So that we mm-hmm. really have an obligation to bring these forward again.
I was astonished. The G major quartet of his, for example, I think is only about 50 years old in terms of performances.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I play a small work of Bartók that's a masterpiece that has been out of print and is out of print, and there's no hope of reviving it and will be lost unless something is done.
Could you, switching streams here, if that's the expression for a moment, could you share with us what it is like for you working in a recording studio as opposed to the concert platform? Do you prepare in a different way? Do you permit yourself to record only in fragments to be pieced together later, or what?
I don't like to do that. I think that something terrible is lost. And I think that generally people are speaking of that now, that when one is playing the music as a complete performance for people, that one has brought up some elements of oneself that are different than one is trying to simply get all the notes straight and all the rhythms straight. Recordings often sound that they are letter perfect, but that the surge, the yearning emotional content is simply not there. And that comes from a critical attitude in the recording studio. And often performances which were recorded live may have less of the ultimate control, but that there's something missing. I think the answer lies in looking at the studio recording as a different art form. I think Glenn Gould spoke about this most carefully, where he said that he likes to see the recording more as the editor of a film would, that he is taking 5 notes here, 10 notes there, 20 notes here, just as the film editor would, taking a scene here, scene there, and putting it all together in the cutting room. And he felt that we listen to recordings differently, and what we want at home is the ability on the 20th and 30th hearing to dive deeply down into the music and hear all the inner voices. So I think that there are two types of recordings. One is being done very well, which is the piecing together and giving us absolute letter-perfect performances, which lack a certain human element, which serve a purpose in a way. One can get into admiring the music and admiring the each particular shape. It's like going over to an impressionist painting and noticing every little dot and admiring every little dot. What one doesn't see is that the painting is of a lady. That is, to me, more intriguing, but often then those performances that have surge and excitement and daring lose something in the terms of ultimate control of tone color. So there are happy mediums, and that has been done and will be done.
In whose hands, however, does an ultimate control reside in that control room? Who chooses what take, or who chooses whether this take will be split up and hooked up with another one? How much of that is yours, as a matter of fact?
It's usually the various people involved. A few weeks ago, I recorded some of the soundtrack for Sophie's Choice, and there in the room was me with Marvin Hamlisch, and it's two people who are greatly gifted in the art of recording. And the ultimate choices were left to me for performance, and I told them which ones I liked and would do over until I was happy with the performance. When it finally came down to choosing the takes, they chose from earlier takes, but explained to me why they were doing it, that there might have been a pedal noise on one, or there was a certain setting of microphone, and one just has to leave it to them because they are expert. But I think it depends on the seriousness of the artist. I know there have been artists who have demanded certain takes and whatever, and they are given a nice nod and don't worry, it'll be done, and the recording engineers have chosen the takes and the artists never knew the difference. So it depends on who you're speaking of.
Lauren Hollander, I hope you'll forgive me for madly skipping around topics with what little time I have left, because I just have to ask you about the genesis of Up Against the Wall and what it has meant to you in terms of a concert career, a public image, or whatever.
Virtually nothing. Up Against the Wall was an improvisation I did on the stage about 69, that was about 13 years ago. It was recorded live, is the only reason anyone knows anything about it. I wrote it down somewhat afterwards because a friend asked me for a copy of it. I've literally not given it a thought since then, and I've never played it before or since.
I ask because Keith Jarrett makes, much is being made of Keith Jarrett's performances now, and is it at all appropriate to find a comparison between that and what Jarrett is doing now?
Certainly. That is what it was. And improvisation is something that's always intrigued me. And I have often left over open a portion of the program for just improvisation. And it would be probably very similar to what Keith does, which is a creative brainstorming, just playing what comes into your head and going with it at the moment. It is not composition. I would not record such a thing. I think that it's sort of just fun to do, while a composition is something where the structure itself must mirror a crystalline elegance. And that does not happen in improvisation unless one is totally in the hands of some muse, as a Mozart was.
I wouldn't know whether to call it a stunt or not, but have you ever considered the idea of improvising a cadenza, say, for a given piano concerto you were performing?
No, because, again, the cadenzas we would be called upon to do that for, the concerti that we would have to do that for, are such important works of art, and that their creators were such visionaries, that it would be an insult to the music to do that. These cadenzas, even if we write a cadenza, it is such a pure substitute, such a poor substitute for what is needed. I have never heard a cadenza written by anyone but Mozart for Mozart Concerto that was not an embarrassment. Even a great cadenza is an embarrassment when it comes to...
Even the ones Geza Honda did for his series?
Anyone. I mean, we're talking about Mozart. Mm-hmm. We're talking about a force of creative vision that there is just no precedence in Western history for. And Mozart dealt with something because he saw it. I don't know a single interpreter who actually is on that plane or who has ever touched it.
Speaking of this, before I get off of it, however, I can't think of any other concert pianists, however, who do improvise at all, or who go to the places like the Fillmore that you do to perform. Do you see yourself occupying a rather unique position in any of those respects?
Well, I've done some things in my life which were unique, and I continue to do them. They are somewhat more behind the scenes. I am now much more involved in some of the ultimate questions of creativity, and my work often parallels some of the work of music psychology or music therapy, trying to find the very questions of how the creative process works. You know, since you've been involved in music all of your life, that some of the elements of stage fright are a very puzzling phenomenon, and that the control of the musical gifts and control of rhythm and the expression is a very tenuous mechanism. We don't know enough about these things, and the type of experience that robs creativity in children, how the child feels put down by the teachers or the grown-ups and then turns off some part of himself creatively, that is a mechanism we don't fully understand. So in this area, I've become fairly well-known within that fraternity. As to performance, the improvisations or whatever I do for my own fun and the outreach programs I do because I think we have to do them, but I'm not a very ambitious person when it comes to career. I'm not interested in the big career. I tend to want to be alone and play with things that I'm interested in. But I am becoming more and more interested in sharing ideas about creativity with the universities. And I think the residency programs are completely unique and that something really is accomplished there. They make a difference that for the first time people can come together to discuss their fears in their performances in music, that I find young performers who are afraid to discuss these things with their peers and with their teachers, that what they are tormented by and what they are terrified of in getting on the stage and performing, or even going into the studio and performing, or their fears and paranoias about their colleagues, they have no one to discuss these things with. And I find that by opening it up into a forum, that some good can happen in the community by sharing these problems among themselves.
One final thing, then. You've mentioned the word therapy several times. Does it sound too much like science fiction to suggest that in the future we may have music doctors in the medical sense of the term?
I think we have this now, and without poking fun at it, I think that music therapy goes beyond what it began as, which was a route into the world of the autistic or the highly disturbed, aberrant behavior child or a human being. The field now is fascinated with music therapy because, indeed, if we were to find the very structures of human consciousness and the relationship of the mind to the body and control of the body in all people, let alone musicians, we would find that those mechanisms and the mechanisms that become distorted and become emotional difficulties, in other words, if we were to find the mechanisms underneath the emotional problems of human beings, we would find the same mechanisms that can be addressed by music therapy, and that we may have discovered here the most direct route and the most intuitive route to the very processes that make human beings conscious.
New life for the doctrine of affections, it sounds like. Very interesting. I hope that we'll be maybe learning from you more about that, which leads me to ask you, finally, will you be in Kansas City anytime within the next year or so, do you think?
I don't know. I return every 6 months or so to St. Louis, and I do not come here that often, but I love this community and have many friends here, so I hope that something will be arranged where I'll be coming more often.
Well, we love you here in Kansas City. The public acclamation of the performance of the Cacciatorian Piano Concerto attests to that. Lauren Hollander, thank you very much for taking the time to visit with me.
Well, thank you. Bye.
To sit and talk like this.